Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and today I'm coming to you from Des Moines, Iowa, where the Iowa State Fair is getting underway. The fair is all but mandatory for primary candidates, and in the coming days, just about every candidate running for president will stop by the Des Moines Register's soapbox to give their stump speeches. I'm here working on a story about how our primary process works, which you will hear more about soon. But while I'm in town, I wanted to check in with somebody that we at 538 have called the best pollster in politics. And that person, of course, is Ann Selzer. She heads the polling firm Selzer & Co. and conducts the Iowa poll for the Des Moines Register. Hello, Ann.
Hi, good to see you.
You too. How's it going?
Welcome to Iowa. It's going great.
Thank you. It's a beautiful day here.
Isn't it?
So I should also mention that Selzer & Co. received one of only six A-plus ratings of the nearly 400 pollsters that we've rated as part of 538's pollster rankings. And I want to talk about Iowa and a whole lot more, but let's just start with this. What goes into being a top-notch pollster? Not to flatter you.
No, well, thank you. Thank you. As I say, may it always be so. I think one of the things that we do that is different from not every polling firm, but many, is that we do what I call polling forward, not polling backward. That is, there are a lot of likely voter models that take a look at what's happened in the past, and then they build a model of what they think is going to happen in the future. And in social science, there's a basic tenet that is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. The Selzer corollary to that, or objection to that is, unless there's change. So the way that we define a likely voter model may seem simplistic, but it lets our data tell us who likely voters are. So whenever I hear pollsters saying, well, here's our model and things have been weighted to look like the expected electorate, I think, well, how do you know? What makes you think that? And most of the time, it's based on what has happened in the past.
I mean, is that particularly applicable to Iowa, given how frequently it can change political winds in some sense, both in the primary or caucus polling, but also in general elections, right?
Well, certainly. It's a swing state. And so from time to time, small changes in turnout can have a dramatic effect on who ends up winning. And we see that happen rather consistently over the years. But it was the 2008 caucus on the Democratic side that really brought that lesson home, which is when our data in the final poll showed that Barack Obama was going to win by a comfortable margin, and that was going to be driven by close to 60% of the people showing up on the Democratic side, that would be their first caucus. There is not a likely caucus-goer model on the planet that would predict, based on past caucuses, that more than half of the people would come to their first caucus. So we didn't get in the way of our data showing that to us, and the entrance poll confirmed that is exactly what happened on caucus night.
And it was actually that poll that flew in the face of the conventional wisdom of the moment that made you somewhat of a household name in politics. It also got you a lot of backlash from the media, from the Clinton campaign. You know, we have some experience with this at 538, but I'm curious, what is your job like when you are putting out data that does not reflect or contradicts the conventional wisdom or the narrative of the moment?
Well, I had a reporter say, that sounds like you live on a lonely island. And I said, yes, that's right. That is, once our data are out and we've had our final say, you know, what I say is we've taken our best shot. But then people, the media, the other campaigns, they want to take their shot at our poll and complain about it and say, I'll be fired. And then I've made all of these assumptions. And there's no point in me saying anything. I just sit on my hands and we'll soon enough know if it's going to be good or not. But it is a tough time.
And what is that feeling like, finding out whether or not it was predictive of the actual result?
Well, you know that you're going to be golden or a goat. So you kind of have to live in the day or two between that, thinking, okay, well, if I end up being a goat, here's what I'll say. And if I end up being golden, I of course want to be graceful and gracious and modest. So that, you know, it's just tricky.
So Iowan. So even though 538's analysis shows that polls are about as reliable as they have ever been, in recent years, particularly after the 2016 election, there's been you know, skepticism from the public, but also sincere questions within the polling community about what it takes to reach a representative sample of the population. How are you dealing with those challenges in the polling that you're doing, reaching a representative sample of Iowans?
Right. Again, part of it is the likely voting model, which I talked about before, but part of it is that we don't have an expectation of how those demographics are going to flow, but we collect demographics on everybody we talk to, so we can weight that big pool of people we talk to known demographics, and then pull out the likely voters from that. And that gives us, I think, more stability in the small group of voters that we're talking to. This is getting pretty wonkish, but I know you've got a wonkish following.
Indeed, we do. But in terms of people moving away from landlines, of course, you poll cell phones as well.
We do.
Pollsters are starting to go online in an effort to try to better sample the population. Do you think these are all kind of good experiments to try? Do you see any problems in the way that polling is headed?
I'm not an expert in their techniques, but the question I have is, here you have a group of people who've held up their hand and said, poll me. So first of all, from a science standpoint, you wonder about some bias in the types of people who are willing to be repeatedly polled in these panels. And then secondly, how do you know how to constitute a group of likely voters from that? I think you have to look backwards and see what's happened before, or you're going to be blinded to what is coming forward. So I'll just, by way of example, go back to that 2008 election. I got a call from someone I have worked with on other projects in the past, from high up the chain in the Hillary Clinton campaign, and saying, I've always trusted your work until now, but I've knocked on 99 doors, and I don't find this lurking Obama support. To which I said, tell me about the 99 doors. Oh, previous caucus attenders and registered Democrats. So right there, blinded to what the Obama campaign was doing in Iowa, which was creating new caucus goers and specifically looking at people who were not registered as Democrats, who were looking at people who were registered independents to come and show up. So anybody who is looking backwards, you have to worry that they're blinded to changes that are happening that are going to show up at a future event.
And so are you in many ways using the same practices that you've used going back to the 80s at the Des Moines Register?
Yes.
It's good to hear that some things haven't changed. So I want to talk specifically about Iowa and this cycle. What does your polling tell us about the state of the race in Iowa right now?
We have a lot of candidates, and that makes...
You don't say.
And that makes polling very difficult. It's a very expensive population to poll because it's a low incidence event. So as we try to find these people who already know in June, which was the last time we polled, that they're going to show up at a caucus, we spend a lot of money just finding them. And now we're going to take up most of the interviewing time just running through the list of candidates to find out how they feel about them, who's their first choice, who's their second choice. And it's just, the frustration is how much content about why they're feeling the way they do and what's the shape of the race, what's the mood of the electorate. That makes it just more frustrating than anything else.
I know in your June poll that Joe Biden was leading,
yes,
that Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders also had significant support. Looking through the crosstabs in that poll, did you see any trends that would lead you to come to some kind of conclusions about how the polls could move in the future, how strong certain candidates' support is?
Well, I didn't have to look in the crosstab so much to see it, although I'll turn to that in a second. One thing we did is just listening to how people were talking about this long list of candidates. They would have some favorites, plural, and then they would have some people who were on the list that they're thinking about it. They would use that language. So I kind of wanted to know, well, who are they actively considering? Because if you think about it, with 24 candidates, 100 percentage points isn't a lot to go around. So looking just at the first choice, it's very hard for many candidates to get any.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask first choice, we ask second choice, because in Iowa, on the Democratic side, you can realign at caucus, so that's good to know. And then we asked, we went through the list one more time, well, if they're not a first or second choice, are you actively considering? And we can add those three percentages together and get what I called a candidate footprint. And that was revelatory in that while Joe Biden had a lead in first choice, Elizabeth Warren had the same size footprint, though she was behind by several percentage points. It also showed us that Kamala Harris had a majority saying they were at least actively considering. And those were two candidates who then, this is before the first debates, ended up doing well in the debates, and their numbers improved there. So Iowans who have seen more of these candidates than most of the rest of the country, this to me was sort of foreshadowing of what could happen with a good debate performance.
There you go, making the case for the intelligence and foresight of Iowans.
But that's kind of a cool little moment.
Yeah.
Hey, our data showed this.
Yeah, and so how big is the footprint of these candidates like Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris at this point?
So 61% for Biden and for Warren. Bernie Sanders is at 56. Then Pete Buttigieg, who was virtually nowhere just 2 months earlier, 3 months earlier, at 52, tied with Kamala Harris at 52. And those were the only candidates of the two dozen who had a majority saying they were being actively considering. Now, keep in mind, every respondent could say they were actively considering every candidate, but they didn't. So this really gives us a feel of a true top tier.
Were there any other trends in looking through the crosstabs, digging through the data? We can get wonky here if you like. I think our audience can take it. That you saw that were notable, that felt like it helped give you a better understanding of where this race is headed?
Well, the one that I can speak about was that our previous poll had been pretty much a love letter to Joe Biden saying, get in the race, get in the race, the water's warm, people like you, they think you're the best, you know, and then he got into the race. And that while he clearly still led, there was a shakiness underneath. So there was less enthusiasm among his supporters. There was just an overall sense that his number was being propped up by some holdover affection. And the same, I thought, was true for Bernie Sanders. So those are the two candidates who have actively campaigned in Iowa before, and yet the underneath was a little shakier. And you saw these other candidates coming on with a bit more strength.
You mentioned earlier the foresight that Iowans had because of having the opportunity to meet so many candidates. In an increasingly diversifying country, and in particular in the Democratic Party, an increasingly diversifying party, there's been some criticism about Iowa's first-in-the-nation status being a pretty white state, not necessarily being reflective of the national population or the population within the parties. How do you respond to that criticism? Do you think that is a fair thing to think about in doing all of this?
I think there's two parts to that question. So I'll see if I can remember what these two parts are. The first is certainly identity politics and the idea that people want to vote for someone who looks like them. And if that were the case, Barack Obama would not have been elected president and Hillary Clinton would have, because women are the majority of voters. So I sort of questioned that idea from the get-go. And it was Iowa where Barack Obama won a comfortable victory in the Iowa caucuses in 2008, which is probably the whole reason he was able to win the nomination. That if you can win in Iowa, it shows you can win. And so I wonder about when people say it's not reflective, well, what would be different? What different outcome? Because historically, candidates of color have actually done rather well in Iowa. They don't trail. Again, it's they do better than their representative of the African-American community here. Jesse Jackson did rather well. Alan Keyes on the Republican side has done well. You know, they didn't win, but there's just sort of, I don't know what data people are looking at to say that candidates of color can't do well in Iowa.
So, well, I guess one question might be on the issues in particular as well. For example, when you poll different communities across the country, white liberals, while they may be totally in favor of voting for non-white candidates, may have different priorities, for example, in terms of policy. And those priorities get spoken to along the trail during the, you know, caucus campaigning. Whereas communities of color, of course, there is South Carolina down the line, but by then we've already had the narratives coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire. Maybe those communities of color have different priorities that don't get spoken to the same extent by the candidates. I mean, I guess that's a possibility, right?
That was, in fact, the second
I
was going to say, speak to, which is, are there different issues that matter? And I guess I'm going to say two things. First of all, the candidates in the national fora, and they're getting more attention there, are talking about healthcare, and they're talking about, well, this week, guns. You know, they're talking about issues that are not necessarily Iowa, they're not necessarily South Carolina, they're not necessarily urban versus rural. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's an interesting question that's open, but the other side of that is that eventually the nominee is going to need to run not just in urban centers. They're going to need to run nationwide, and they're going to need to run in red states, and hopefully, from their point of view, flip some of those. So having a grounding in issues that are not just urban issues maybe makes a better candidate.
Well, I guess this is a whole topic that you could debate for a while. And in some ways, the Democratic Party is. But in other ways, I think the Democratic Party is still just embracing the significance of Iowa and New Hampshire as the first in the nation. However, right, California, this primary will be unique in the sense that early voting in California will begin the same day as the Iowa caucuses. Has that changed at all, do you think, how much importance either the media or candidates or the party in general is placing on Iowa? Have you sensed that California is taking some of the attention away?
I have not. But here's why. Because how much money do you need to win California?
A lot.
How much money do you need to win Iowa?
Well, I guess when there's a ton of competition, maybe you do need quite a bit of money.
You might need more.
Definitely a smaller media market.
From the beginning of the campaign until caucus night, there are known to be 3,000 events planned. Now, in Iowa, that's a critical mass. In California, 3,000 events, right? It's a drop in the bucket. So it's the scale of Iowa that enables candidates to see that that's a bar they can hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that part is meaningful. The second part is that the most important thing a candidate can do is win. So winning, if it's important, you want to be the first to win. And Iowa is the first place to do it.
Right. You're not going to get results in California until much later than
Correct.
You'll get those results in Iowa. We were talking a little bit about how reflective or not Iowa is of the nation as a whole. I mean, what are the characteristics of the Iowa electorate or the Iowa population in general?
Well, do you mean caucus goers or do you mean population?
I guess both, because, of course, as you mentioned with 2008, the caucus going population can change depending on the race.
It can. I don't have in front of me the state population, but it's 90% white. The numbers I have from polling results, people are able to say they don't want to tell us their race. So my numbers aren't census numbers. But it's also older. We're older than the nation generally. And those two things kind of distinguish it. We are the state that has the highest high school graduation rate of any state. So there are tons of ways that we're just a little bit different from the nation overall.
Now, the Iowa caucuses are changing, right?
Yes.
The Democratic Party has made some changes to the rules that potentially is making your life harder, or at least you've had to come up with some workarounds to figure out how to poll in accordance with those new rules. First off, I mean, is it harder to poll a caucus than a primary simply because people can change their minds at the high school where they're gathering, you know, and their initial preference may not be the same as their final preference?
There are 17 ways in which caucuses are harder to poll than primaries.
Wait, literally 17? Or did you just come up with that number? Okay.
That's not a bad guess. But yeah. First of all, you can register on caucus night, but that's true of primaries as well. You can change your party registration on caucus night. You can be 17 and participate if you're going to be 18 by the time of the general election. The only thing you can really hope to poll is what people intend to do when they walk into the caucus room, because caucuses are designed for things to happen in the room. And if you need any better example of that, go talk to the Ted Cruz campaign in 2016, because they changed what happened in the outcome by what they did in that caucus room, and the Trump campaign was a neophyte and did not know what was that was supposed to happen in those. It was 2016 caucus was Trump's to lose, and lose it he did. So there are, you know, many more ways that it's more difficult, but it is also a very small universe. So primaries bring out more people. Caucuses, you give up your Monday night in February, and you're going to spend a couple of hours, often in a crowded gym, standing around, waiting for things to happen. And for some, it's an exhilarating experience. For some, it's a miserable experience.
How has the Democratic Party of Iowa changed the rules this time around?
So the National Party said, you've got to figure out a way to be more cognizant that there are people who can't devote 2 to 3 hours on a Monday night to participate in the caucus. So they have come up with the idea of holding a handful of virtual caucuses. And these rules have not yet been finalized, but as they sit today, there will be, as I say, a handful of opportunities for you, if you want, not you, but
as somebody who's not an Iowan.
An Iowan, to say, that sounds good to me. To do that, they've got to register with the party saying, I'm going to caucus virtually. And then you're locked into that. You cannot change your mind and say, I'm going to show up in person because now I'm excited. No. You will use your phone, as I understand it, that this will be through smartphones, and a meeting will be convened. And it's going to be kind of like going to a caucus. There'll be messages from the party chair. There'll be messages from the candidates. It will be time-consuming. And they will go through the list of candidates 5 times, I think, for you to give your preferences. No matter how many choose to participate that way, all of those preferences will account for 10% of the delegates.
So even if, say, 50% of Iowans were to join these virtual caucuses, it would count as 10% of the delegates, and the in-person caucus goers would get 90% of the delegates.
That's correct. And the reason for that is that the party always assigns delegates to precincts based on what's happened before. They don't know what's going to happen. So they've got to put a number on it, and they've got to do that ahead of the game.
It's interesting. In general, in Iowa, you will have a split between, you know, the popular vote, you could say, and the delegate assignments after the night is over, just because there could be discrepancies in how many delegates a particular area gets versus how many people actually turn out.
And for the first time, the party will be reporting out what happened on caucus night 3 different ways.
Okay.
So in the past, they've always reported out only the delegate equivalent. So they will still do that, and that includes the assignment of 10% to the virtual caucuses, 90% to the people who showed up. They will also report out the initial intent, so in a raw count. They've never done that before, and they will also report out the final preferences in a raw count.
So I am sure that they are doing that in the interest of transparency. As somebody who works in the media, I also imagine that what will end up happening is that there will be a cluster of different narratives, potentially depending on the result, coming out of the Iowa caucus, meaning that somebody may win the initial preference, somebody may win the final preference, somebody may win the most delegates, and a different person may win the popular vote in both of those different counts, right? The initial popular vote and the final popular vote.
And someone may win the in-person and someone may win the virtual. I mean, it's
If there isn't a clean narrative coming out of Iowa, does that lessen its impact on the race going forward? Or does it just become one big spin room and somebody will eventually win the media narrative?
Well, it's hard to say without having data in hand and having done this before. I think what it potentially means, most easy to predict, is that there will be more tickets coming out of Iowa. There'll be more people able to claim some sort of legitimacy for their campaign.
And how does all of this affect your job as a pollster in figuring out, are you trying to determine the answer to all of those questions? Who might win in virtual? Who might win in person? Who might win in the initial preference? Who might win in the final preference? Who might get the most delegates? And who might win the popular vote?
Yes.
Oh, dear. Okay. So how are you doing it?
So ahead of our June poll, we spent hours and hours and hours trying to get our heads wrapped around how to do this. Again, not knowing how many people we might poll who would opt to do it virtually, participate virtually versus in person. I was very interested in getting an early exercise in how we were going to combine these together. So we worked out a methodology and were able to keep the in-person group separate from the virtual group and to put them together as a delegate equivalent, but also to be able to look at those two groups separately. And that is our method going forward.
And did you see a discrepancy in who likely virtual caucusers versus likely in-person caucusers?
The discrepancy was really more a matter of degree. So what we learned is that in the people who said they would attend in person, Joe Biden, the leader, got 23% of the first choice votes. Those who were going to attend virtually, he got 33% of the first choice votes.
Interesting.
Now, you meld those together with the 90-10% idea, waiting, and you get 24% for Joe Biden. So that's it's a nice demonstration that he was more popular. He had more support from the virtual side, but it added a single percentage point when the two groups are combined.
And do you have a sense of why those discrepancies in virtual versus in-person exist? Is it a different type of voter?
Somewhat. It's a younger type of voter, but mostly what we saw is that they are less knowledgeable about the field. So when we look at the feeling thermometer, when we ask, okay, how do you feel about them? And one of the potential answers is, I don't know enough to tell you how I feel. There was often like a 10-point gap that they were less likely to know these candidates. So they're more new to the idea. There was a bigger proportion of them who said that this would be their first caucus. Among the people who were going to attend in person, 17% said this would be their first caucus. Among those who said they would caucus virtually, 52% said it would be their first caucus. So these are newcomers and kind of neophyte.
In terms of that split, 90% of the delegates going to the in-person caucus goers, 10% going to the virtual caucus goers. Is that somewhat similar to their actual proportions in the electorate right now? Like, did more than 10% of people that you polled say that they planned to caucus virtually?
That number was 28%.
That creates an interesting dynamic in that in the process of trying to open up the caucus experience and allow more people in by caucusing virtually, could you have a situation where a lot of the new caucus goers end up caucusing virtually and that weights their votes a whole lot less in the sense that if there was virtual caucusing in 2008 and Obama, 60% of caucus goers were new, if a bunch of those people had caucused virtually, it would have diminished the weight of their votes overall, right?
Right. But the campaigns know. This is not a surprise to them. So it is in their best interest to get their supporters showing up in person. The campaigns know.
And we'll see, I mean, this is fascinating. There's going to be so much to cover for us at 538, so many data details for us to cover at 538 coming out of the caucuses. As we wrap up here, what questions are you most interested in exploring between now and the beginning of February when the caucuses take place?
Oh, gosh. We're just always interested in the tipping point questions. But I think this past week is illustrative of the inability of pollsters to know what the final issues are going to be. I mean, we do our best to put some tracking questions in place. We're always interested in enthusiasm. But campaigns are designed to have things happen and candidates react to them. And those are typically the moments that have lasting impact and carry the day.
And so you're talking in particular about the mass shootings and that white nationalist manifesto from one of those shooters. Do you feel that having an impact in Iowa, in the race right now?
Well, we have no data because this is something that we didn't know really to take a look at. I'm just paging through here a little bit. I guess the data that we had in looking at whether some issue positions were must-haves for you in looking at a candidate, we did have here restoring the ban on assault-style weapons. And that was sort of, you know, a modest majority saying that's a must-have. Well, that's nowhere near what we had for recognition of climate change as the greatest threat to humanity, which was the number one, or a woman's right to abortion. Do you know, I mean, there's some other things that are far more baseline democratic sorts of things. I think the one other thing that I found very interesting in this poll, and I don't know how often we will go back to it, was we certainly wanted to know, as other polls have shown, that people are making decisions based on who can be victorious in the general election, and that that's very important to them. We asked a question about qualities that are important. And so we have a list of seven, and we wanted to include electability in there, but then we gave them a chance to choose two, because we figured once they got electability, then we wanted to see what else. Electability ranked fourth.
Wow.
And the top two were integrity and intelligence. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So maybe for this group, electability, well, that's a given. I don't need to waste my vote on this question on that. But the arrows I want in my candidate's quiver to go after that electability are integrity and intelligence. And so I'm sort of going to be watching how candidates present and think about how that style of leadership may be playing to the Iowa audience.
And is that different from years past?
We've never asked that question before.
Final question. What advice do you have to pollsters going into this election season, or even polling consumers like our audience, to keep in mind, right? Because it's a rough and tumble world out there, and it's hard to make sense of all of the data sometimes.
Well, tread carefully. One of the things I worry about in Iowa is that it's a small population, has a lot of candidates, and a lot of people want to poll them. And so I always worry about polling burnout, and I feel a little protective. So I think Iowans make candidates better. And so pollsters should treat that with respect. I mean, this is a process that Iowa has done a far better job on the Democratic side than New Hampshire in the winners going on to win the nomination. So it's an opportunity, and we can all learn something in the process.
All right. Well, I hope with the rest of my time here in Iowa, I also learned plenty from Iowans. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Ann Selzer, who heads the polling firm Selzer & Co. and conducts the Iowa poll for the Des Moines Register. I will, of course, let you know how things go in Iowa this week, and I'm looking forward to being able to tell listeners more about the project we've got planned. In the meantime, my name is Galen Druk. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.